Okay,
It's my great pleasure to meet
you. And I'm going to mute my...
Okay. Thanks, Alyssa. Thank you, everyone, and thank you for your patience. And yes, I'll take a deep breath and try and settle into being present and not panicking about having been locked out of the system. And welcome. And so I also want to pay great respect to all of the very experienced storytellers who are here, who many of whom have worked in the realm of story and healing story for far, far longer than I have. And when I was first asked whether I would like to speak about environmental storytelling, I felt a bit uncertain about it. I'm certainly no authority, but I'll just offer you my thoughts on it, and then we can go into discussion, leave some time. Although we've only got 35 minutes left now, we could leave some time for the rich contributions to hear back from you again. And some of you may have been working in environmental storytelling for some time. Certainly Fran has. And we heard Fran express her views on stealth storytelling, stealth environmental storytelling, and also the wonderful way that Fran uses stories to illustrate principles, scientific principles in especially Barry Commoner's four principles, which you can hear if you go to Fran's recording of her teleconference. And I suppose my angle on environmental storytelling that I want to express, and which some of you may already be in resonance with, is that environmental storytelling can be, of course, much wider than expressing the information that people need to understand in order to get a grip of environmental stories, that scientists have been working from an information deficit model for a long time, and that isn't necessarily what is needed. People don't need more information. They need to emotionally engage with the information, which is where storytelling is the most perfect way. Well, amongst the arts, there are all sorts of different artistic ways to connect people emotionally to information, but storytelling offers a perfect opportunity. And that also that storytelling has a capacity to connect people to themselves, not only to connect them to place, but to connect via stories of place to deeply to themselves and deeply to each other as a community. And that it's very clear that if you want to inspire people to work to protect the planet and understand the deep interrelationship of all living things, that it's easiest for us to connect first with our local place and to move beyond the disconnection that the overculture has tended to imbue us with, that we are separate, that we are individuals, that we are isolated, and that our actions don't make an impact. So I guess the main thread, because we have limited time, the main thread I wanted to discuss was the role of storytelling to actually shift people's ideology and spirituality. And that I've been quite inspired by a story lately that I learned through a program that I've been doing, which was maybe mentioned in the introduction, called Joyality. And it's very much informed by deep ecology and by Joanna Macy's work of The Work That Reconnects, which some of you would probably be aware of. And anyone who hasn't connected with Joanna Macy's work, you can Google her and find her articles and her videos. And you can even hear her actually tell the story of the Shambhala warrior, which I was planning to tell today. And for me, what's important about those stories is that although we do need stories to explain to people the importance of that water is life and to connect people to that spiritual understanding, we also need individual facts about environmental issues and climate change and so on. Overall, I feel like we can also use storytelling to crack the spell that we're under this culture, the separation, and to reconnect us to another way of being, and to reconnect us to traditional ways of understanding and connecting to the understanding that it's not just we need to reconnect to nature, that we are nature, and those sorts of stories that actually cracks the spell that we've been under, and that we need to let go of everything about the system that's not working. And I want to just read a quote that expresses that to a degree for me by Alex Stephan in something he wrote called Sense and Sustainability, which is we don't need more carpool lanes. We need to eliminate fossil fuels from our economy. We don't need recycling bins. We need to create a closed-loop, biomimetic, neobiological industrial system. We don't need to attend a tree planting ceremony. We need to become experts at ecosystem management and gardening the planet. We don't need another unscented laundry detergent. We need to ban the vast majority of toxic chemicals upon which our lifestyles currently float and invent a completely non-toxic green chemistry. We don't need light green fashions. We need a bright green revolution. And that's where I feel that storytelling can either... There are certain situations where we can only tinker at the edges, where we can only make little offerings. When people's consciousness is so removed from nature, you can only gently take them a little step at a time. But what's also called for is the stories that address the cracks that are forming in our culture that are leading to widespread environment, not only environmental problems and social justice issues. And some of those stories can reach more deeply with their roots and crack open the cement or the, you know, the dysfunction of our cultural assumptions and ease people into a new way of thinking. And it's quite shocking, and I can imagine that in America right now with the political situation as it is, that there's a lot that's quite shocking, and obviously the transformation needs to be quite quick so that stories can help to ease us through that. And I know that collectively all of you would have a wealth of experience and stories that would address that very issue. And I guess the story of the Shambhala warrior, which maybe some of you have heard, addresses that for me, but also Laura Sims' story of the most beautiful bird, which she tells, which I'm not going to attempt to tell, but I'll point you to, is another one. And as we discuss those stories, there may be others that you know of that are not just about understanding environmental principles, but actually about actually cracking open everything that's dysfunctional and unsustainable and non-regenerative about the values of our system, which is contributing to all of this, that putting a pipeline through a river and digging up fossil fuels when we need to stop doing so is a symptom of a broader cultural illness, and that stories that address the value systems that lead to those things are deeply important rather than just addressing the symptoms, if you know what I mean. So I was planning to tell you the story as I've refashioned it just from my imagination of the Shambhala warriors, and I was planning to just sit through and run through that before we started. I have to say the whole thing of getting the time wrong has left me feeling a bit jangled. So I'm just going to take a few deep breaths and see how I go with that. And if not, I can return to the script of the Shambhala warriors. And so I'll just aware that time is ticking away. There are many people who have a lot of experience and knowledge in this realm. I'll just attempt to whet your appetite at least by a very shy telling of the Shambhala warriors, and then perhaps open it up to discussion and contributions. And maybe we'll get to hear Papa Joe's story as well. The Shambhala warriors. 12 centuries ago, in northwestern India, Tibetan Buddhists foretold that a time would come when a great doom would hang over the planet. And this situation would have been brought about so that all life hung by the merest thread. And it was caused by barbarians who had squandered vast wealth on weapons of unimaginable destruction. And at this time, there would arise the Shambhala warriors. You would not be able to go to Shambhala, for it was not a place as much as a way of being. And you would not be able to recognize the Shambhala warriors, for they did not wear a uniform or any insignia. And you would not see them carrying any weapons, for they had no weapons as we tend to think of warriors holding. They did not wield guns or bombs. All they had
was two things, compassion and insight. Their compassion gave them the fire and the passion to move forwards, gave them the courage to move into the halls of power of those barbarian forces, to move towards that which they were repulsed by. But they also had the insight that took them beyond an understanding of duality and beyond the duality of good and evil, so that it could step forward towards those barbarians, and an insight into the deep and profound interconnection of all phenomena, the deep ecology, the web of life, that everything is connected to everything. And with that understanding, the Shambhala warriors stepped into the halls of power with all the courage of a warrior, with all the strategic action of a warrior, with the ability to collaborate of a warrior, and the selflessness to protect everything that they believed in of a warrior. But the prophecy does not foretell the ending. It merely asks us, are we, can we be those Shambhala warriors? And so that's a story that's very new for me to tell. It's not a story that I've polished over a long period of time. It's only come to me recently through the duality training, as I mentioned, which was very influenced by Joanna's Macy's work that reconnects, and through a colleague who's become a very good friend of mine called Ishana Bragg, Dr. Ishana Bragg, who studied eco-psychology and brought this story into the duality training. And the duality training aims to connect people through the despair and empowerment that can come from looking full in the face of everything that's happening on the planet, that if you have any compassion for creatures or the planet or people, you will feel this deep, you can feel this deep despair at times. And so it offers a process to work through that despair and move towards empowerment. And that story is at the heart of that work, which is done in circles. And so that is the most, there are other stories that I mentioned that I could tell in this setting, but I feel that that's the most powerful one. And I also want to reference to Laura Sims' story, The Most Beautiful Bird, which I call The Bird with the Most Beautiful Song, when I finally figured out how to retell it. It took me a long time to be able to work and create it, reweave a new version, because Laura's was so exquisite. But for me, that story, which is deeply about connecting to the deep spirituality of singing the songs and dancing the dances of the earth, that expresses the antithesis of what's expressed in the Shambhala warriors, that we need to develop this close eco-spirituality and reverence that the indigenous people have modeled and nurtured that understanding for us and kept it close to their heart, so that we can now rediscover it and maybe rediscover that of our ancestors if we're not indigenous. So those two stories for me are the ones that I wanted to focus on today. So with that, I hope that's enough of a start. I didn't want to talk for very long because I'm aware that there are so many people that know so much on this call. I hope that's enough for people if they want to now throw in something of their own or ask a question or engage. Then please do so.
Well, Jenny, I hope you will tell us a little bit more this labyrinth work and story, and how you help people to foster stories of place in your shops.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
All right, good. It's good to know what you'd like to hear. I started researching towards doing a PhD in environmental storytelling, and then I realized that the academic realm didn't fit for me. It wasn't a good fit to do that. I didn't want to start speaking in an academic way. It felt like in order to do that, I would have had to use such dense words that wasn't the path for me. But in doing that, I came across the work of, I came across a lot of different articles. That's where I found the story of Joanna Macy's work. And I realized that one of the most important things to help people connect to the environment was stories of place, which I hear that you were discussing before I managed to join the call. And that by through telling just even ordinary stories of place in your own community, that that was a way of building community and building connection to place, and then noticing where you actually are, because it's easy in our culture to not notice where you are. For instance, a really important thing in the Southern Hemisphere is that a lot of our cultural seasonal celebrations are based on the Northern Hemisphere of, you know, those of us who came from the Northern Hemisphere, our ancestors brought those traditions, and being connected into a global system, you know, Easter is still celebrated at a time that makes sense for you. Here, it's autumn. It doesn't make sense to celebrate the renewal of life and Easter eggs and spring when it's autumn. It's more relevant, really, for us to celebrate the beloved dead as things go into recess. So there's one level is actually noticing where we are in our stories as well as in our rituals and our celebrations, and to me they're all interconnected. And the other layer is actually then moving further into what are the bioregional implications of our seasons? Because, in fact, even if we just flip for the Southern Hemisphere, even if we flip our seasons so that we just notice, okay, this is not a time for telling Easter stories, this is a time for telling stories of Samhain, if you were just to flip it over. In fact, it's more complicated than that here and probably in many places in the Southern Hemisphere, because our seasons don't match your four seasons of 3 months each. Our seasons are much more variable, and in fact Australian people are only just coming to terms with that, that we've still got this cognitive dissonance going because we haven't fully arrived in where we are. And then on top of that, there's this layer of being unable to really deeply access the Aboriginal stories of place, because the Aboriginal stories of place, which may be the case for many of your Indigenous traditions, are sacred stories. They're not just folk tales that anyone can tell. They're actually a part of the initiation process. They're actually a part of the cultural knowledge that goes with land, and are only revealed as you become increasingly initiated as you go through your life journey. And so, as non-Indigenous people, as non-initiated people, we can only access the children's stories, and sometimes not even those, because of the transgressions that have happened. There's even more sensitivity about releasing those stories. Some groups are very generous and very able to share those stories, and others not. So it's quite a complex thing here for us in Australia. We need to bridge the gap. And in fact, I was recently at a weekend where we were actually exploring to some level. We didn't explore the story as such. We didn't rewrite the story as such, but we were contemplating at a spiritual level the stories of place that formed this region, with permission from the traditional custodians, because as people who love our region, as environmentalists who are passionate about it, we feel the deep need to connect with the spirituality of this place, to make sense of it. And how do we do that when our ancestors came from far away and have a completely different set of stories, where the magical creatures and the spiritual creatures are of a completely different landscape? And how do we claim the stories of this place without then transgressing against the local Indigenous people here and doing something, you know, that their stories belong to them? And we have to get permission to tell their stories, and it's not a straightforward process. So there's that aspect of it. So I started doing local story concerts, and I'm about to start again. Initially, I made the provocation was very, very small regional area that I said was just Byron Shire. I come from the most easterly tip of Australia, so the part that sticks out on the east coast of Australia is where I come from. And we started telling those stories, and it really fostered a beautiful sense of community and identity, and some really special stories came out of that. In that process, I was also weaving stories for a story walk that I was creating for the foreshore, with the view to helping not only visitors to the region, but locals connect to place through stories. And so I started creating the stories of our caldera. Actually, apparently I've just discovered, theoretically, it's not a caldera. We all talk about it as a caldera because it has this big round cauldron shape And our area was carved by this magnificent mountain, this huge shield volcano, millions and millions of years ago. And so I just started creating a story based on that geological fact and working to make it more artistic, because when you look for the story of the geology, it's often in language that's quite difficult to penetrate unless you're a geologist. So when I did the research, I had to wade through a lot of dull technical descriptions, and I tried to weave that story and physicalize that story and show with my body the way that the continent moved over a great volume of lava that pushed up the mountains. And so I'm showing with my hands and my body, as storytellers do, how the mountain was pushed up, and then with my arms, you know, physicalizing how the lava poured out in so many directions, and trying to give analogies which would work in people's heads more vividly than is generally given. I've often read the story of the creation of our region by that volcano and not really engaged with it. So my attempt was to really ignite people's imagination with it, and I've recently gone and done that in a classroom with students. And when I do it, people really, they light up. And it gives you a new, when you look at the very spectacular scenery that's here, you can see that story from long ago. And I suppose that was also inspired by coming across the deep time walk, that also comes from the deep ecology tradition, where you make a spiral and you start walking at the center with the Big Bang, and you slowly walk and walk and walk out, and slowly... I think many of you would have been familiar with that kind of timeline that you see. Sometimes you see a video, which is if you were to conflate the time of the creation of the world since the Big Bang, or that, you know, and looked at it within a time frame of a week, where we would have only arrived in the last little while, or if it was 24 hours, we would have arrived in the last 3 minutes, something like that. So the deep time walk is about starting with your Big Bang and walking out and out and out, and realizing how long it took for life to form, and how late in the day came mammals, and how late in the day came humans. And it gives you that sense of humility and the scale of where we are in the scale of things, that can lead to that deep spiritual reverence for the wonder and the magnitude of life, that it's so amazing. It's such an amazing miracle that it, the way that it unfolded in such beauty and such complexity, and therefore how vulnerable and precious it is to inspire us to then to step back from feeling like we're the apex species, and that we need to actually honour all of the interconnectedness of life, which we rely on anyway. So that's kind of where I was coming from with the stories of place, is finding ways to express, you know, the majesty and the power of nature and the deep history of how this place came to be. And in that story, when I've got the story of Wollumbin and it's pouring out this lava that's 1200 degrees centigrade, and it's pouring lava that was enough to fill the Sydney Harbour, which I don't know if any of you are familiar with, it's a vast harbour. It could have filled it 5,000 times, trying to give analogies that give a sense of the scale. And then that lava stretched out over a vast region that we now call the Rainbow Region. So there's a sense that why is there this similarity of ethos and values and alternative culture and environmental reverence? And maybe we're connected because the lava flowed as far as that Rainbow Region that we talk about is. So maybe, you know, that gives us a sense of understanding of the foundations of that time. And you know, we had stories of the song lines when we tried to have an Aboriginal teller from the region come and tell a story at every concert. We didn't always manage to get somebody at every concert, but we usually did have, and we heard stories of the song lines that stretch across Australia. And so the work with labyrinths was connected to this desire to connect people to place. Sometimes people, and I'm presuming most of you probably know what a labyrinth is, but just to clarify, sometimes people get confused with the difference between a labyrinth and a maze. And a labyrinth is a path which there's only one path that leads to the center and then leads you out again. The most powerful labyrinths tend to take a circuitous route, and so you may feel like you're coming into the center and then suddenly you'll feel like you're not. It doesn't go just like a spiral inward and inward and then outward and outward. It has a surprising sort of way in and out, which is like a metaphor or a spiritual analogy for the way that life unfolds in curious ways at times. And a maze is something you can actually get lost in. So that's like the shadow side of the labyrinth. And the labyrinth is a beautiful way to connect to yourself. And for me, when you make them outdoors, which is what I've mostly done, it's a way to connect to country or to land as well. And some people think of labyrinths as like an acupressure points on the planet, that you can connect to place energetically and spiritually by walking the labyrinth. And even if you don't believe in that, it's certainly a way of creating a guided meditation, a walking meditation to connect with yourself. That if you find it difficult to sit and meditate, it's another way of connecting to self in a reverent way. And just briefly, my experience with storytelling and labyrinths was that when I met Dr. Artress, who was one of the people who inspired the labyrinth renaissance in worldwide, starting in America, she talked about the practice of telling stories within the labyrinth as people were walking it. And so I was at a labyrinth summer school, and I took a story which I had written, Golden Heart, and I stood on the outside and began telling the story as I walked the labyrinth. And in that process, it was a very profound experience of really deeply feeling that story, a way of meditating upon the story, a story which I had written myself some 16 years ago. And it still brought another layer of realization about what that story was for me and how it had meaning for me in my life, in my own family's, what was happening in the dynamic of my own family, and also in the how it related to the overculture, because the story of Golden Heart is about the story of reconnecting to the heart. And I see that the stories of reconnecting to the divine feminine, reconnecting to that softness and allowing the emotions to be honoured instead of suppressed, is another aspect of the changes that need to shift as we move away from everything that's not working about mainstream culture at the moment. So I've ranged over a very wide territory there, and we're running out of time to hear from other people, so I'd love to leave it there and hear what other people would like to contribute.
I wonder if you could tell us where to find the story of the bird, the most beautiful bird.
That would be a good thing to, maybe we could post that on the Healing Story Alliance, because Laura has recorded that story on one of her CDs. And I think that, I'm not sure if it's still available online though. So I think she sells digital downloads of her stories, so you may be able to find it, the most beautiful bird, online. So I will ask Laura if she has a link to that, and or a link to the text. So I'm not quite sure about that, where she's at with that, but pretty sure it is published in a book as well.
Jenny,
she's written.
Can you just tell the bones of it, because it's that in Doorways to the Soul, same story.
Okay. So I know that Laura has done a lot of research on this and worked over on decades and decades, but just the very bones of it is that there is a time and a place where the people who lived in a great, beautiful forest would sing the song of the most beautiful bird and dance the dance and tell the story. And over time, as the forest got cut down, and as as people got busier and the towns grew, people forgot to honour the beautiful bird. The most beautiful bird was the bringer of rain. So when they sang her songs and danced her dances and told her stories and fed her, she would spread her beautiful wings, and as she did so, the rain would fall. And people understood the connection between this reverence for the bird and the coming of the rain. But as time passed and they got too busy, they decided that it was a foolish thing to do, to tell this. It was just a silly story and it wasn't really true anymore. And so a great drought came. But a little boy who was very, very curious went into the forest and saw the most beautiful bird, and she had her head tucked under her wing, and she was, just very, very quiet. And the boy was so amazed and so filled with wonder at this most beautiful bird that he offered her some food, and it rained. And he wondered if this was a coincidence, so he begged his father for some more food to feed the bird, and the father, you know, said, no, don't be ridiculous, we don't have any spare food, you know. But so over time, people came to understand the connection between the bird, through the curiosity of this innocent little boy, that every time he fed the bird, that it would rain. And then people began again to sing the song and dance the dance and tell the story of this most beautiful bird. So I guess it represents for me that eco-spirituality, that deep connection to the land and reverence and understanding it, that it's necessary to be humble, that it's necessary to understand the deep connection, that everything we do connects with everything on the planet.
Yeah. Thank you.
Great. What a lot of richness. Does anybody have a particular question for Jenny?
Or comment? Or story reference?
Well, what brings to mind is the story from Zaire about the frogs and the chief. It's an African story. And you know, you all know that one.
Mm-hmm. What's it called?
Pleasant Spain's book. And it's wonderful because it shows the connectedness and the web of life.
Mm. 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 About the mosquitoes and then the frogs and then the snakes, that one?
Yes, yes, exactly. It's in the book on Nathan Stories, that Pleasant to Spain.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, it's the same principle. Everything's connected.
Everything's connected, that's right. Which is one of the principles that Fran talks about in the Barry Commoners, four principles that everything is connected.
I'd like to ask a question. I was very struck about your talking about the upside-downness of the seasons and the stories. The stories from the north and the reality of the south hemisphere. How do you deal with that? How do you address it?
Well, yeah, good question. We're really grappling with that. It's kind of crazy in a sense that it's taken us so long, but there's new movements arising to grapple with that. And in fact, the weekend that I just attended was not so much a storytelling event as a spiritual focus. So we didn't rewrite new stories, but we did work with the story of the creation of the caldera, and we honoured the Aboriginal custodians who have a very different story which we can't access. So, people are actually still grappling, including me, with what is the seasons of this region, because no one's actually, it's not clearly accessible. That information is still emerging. We're still very much in the grip of our Northern Hemisphere ancestors and their stories and their understanding of the weather. And there has been so much disruption of Aboriginal culture that information is there, but it's not straightforward to access. So it's a growing awareness, and it's very, very slow. It's kind of amazing that in 2017 we haven't got this completely sorted. So, for instance, there's a woman who started Australian. She's written a book on Australian Druidry, and together they have written a different typology of the seasons based on the Sydney bioregion. And so instead of spring, for instance, it's, you know, the time of the bark fall. And I've got it on a wall in another room. Here it is. So the seasons are divided differently. The Sydney coastal wheel of the year is divided into 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 seasons. And they go fire, bark fall, wind change, flowers, hardening, moon, peace, and storms again, back to fire. So that people are still exploring what are our seasons. And in fact, they've drawn it as 8 equidistant seasons, but in fact, Aboriginal understandings that very closely followed what seasonal changes were marked by particular, say, for instance, if you saw that particular tree was flowering, you knew that the mullet were about, the fish were about to, a particular breed of fish were about to come. And so that might be a 6-week period for that part of that season, and then that might be followed by a longer period, and it wasn't equally divided up. So, but yeah, we're actually grappling with that. We haven't really sorted that one out. So a lot of people just flip it, just flip it over and talk about Samhain now. So I'm going on Friday night to a dance that recognises, you know, that reality. But that's not actually relating to our bioregion, because autumn hasn't got the same feeling as it does in the Northern Hemisphere. It's not as dramatic, if that answers your question.
Yes, it certainly does. It's fascinating. It emphasizes the differences and the need to recognize them in order to integrate them.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Jenny?
Pleasure. Yes.
Am I on?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
my name is Judith, and this a quick question. So when telling to children, they are more than willing to embrace an integrated world. When telling to adults, if you can even get them to put, or teenagers, if you can get them to even put their cell phones in their pocket, it seems like you've accomplished a great deal. How do you start to break down those inhibitions and the fact that people live with hardened ironies already and welcome them back in to an integrated view?
That's a big question. I'm just sort of tinkering away in my own way, you know, as best I can. So I'm not sure that I've managed to do that in a big way myself. But I guess I guess in my own community, what I'm wanting to do is tell stories where, so to backtrack, the theories of social dispersion of ideas is that go where it's easiest. So I guess the people who
don't
are most
go perform for the
experience.
Hierarchy at Shell Oil for to start with.
Well, maybe we need to do it all. Like maybe we do need to go into the halls of power and definitely infiltrate with those stories, but maybe to find the people who are the most open to that first and from them work outwards. So I wouldn't say that I'm any of, there might be other people in the call that could answer your question much more expertly than mine, but my strategy is just that if there's a community action or there's a rally, I'll offer to tell a story there. And it might just be hummingbird and elephant, like 1-minute story, because often they've got so many speakers. There isn't time for a lot. So I might just get 1 or 3 minutes, you know, whatever. And just sow that seed in a group that may or may not be used to story, but they're very receptive because they're emotionally upset about something and they want to be soothed. Or to create, to create community concerts which have a focus. I want to, the next series of stories, concerts that I want to run are not just stories of place, but stories of hope. And so there'll be a transformative edge to those stories as well. I have a wider thread to them. But there may be someone else on the call who could answer your story with much more experience than me.
Hi, this is Harry Mishkin.
Hi, Harry.
I don't have an answer to that question, but it definitely touched the thought I was having, which is the need to break out of the storytelling crowd, if you will. It's like preaching to the choir and reaching out to those people that aren't listening for stories about connection to place, but, you know, to get them to start listening, that's the real challenge.
Mm. I'm wondering if with the rise of
reality. I think there is an opportunity now, just because of all the talk about, for instance, climate change and global warming, you know, more people at least perking up their interest. And so I think the opportunity to, you know, address that to the larger crowd, the larger audience, is growing. At least I hope it is.
Yeah. I'm wondering also if a good, if it's possible to access when there are rallies in local areas, if that is a place to tell stories as well, even really brief ones that just introduce people to the concepts of storytelling as a way of soothing our hearts. Because, yes, telling new stories helps people bridge from where they're at to where we're going to and be able to imagine a different way of being.
Yeah. I was just fantasizing one of these stories, get down to Washington for the climate march in a couple of weeks. It would feel wonderful telling there where the energy get kind of angry and frustrated.
I've really enjoyed telling at rallies because people are often really upset and they need something soothing, and a story is something to take home with you.
Right.
I wanted to add one more thing. This is Harry again. And just to touch upon one other thing that you talked about, Jenny, besides stories of place, of connection to place, and that is the story of how we got here, i.e. the billion years of evolution. I did a performance last night on the theme of, is this really happening, connoting all the insane feelings in this country under the current administration. And I wrote a piece, so my performance is part stories and it's part word and music, but I had a part that just mentioned the phrase, the imperative of DNA, i.e. Mm-hmm. like the how we got here, you know, from the primordial seed to the formation of these complex molecules, you know, to things, to protozoans, to the complexity of beings that can have this attribute of awareness is astounding. And are we ready to mess that up? And I think, you know, stories that bring in that context could evoke emotion.
Yeah, they may arise. I don't know if other people have already written them, but a story that encapsulates that could be really beautiful.
I did something. This is Fran. I did something recently, just trying to physicalize the time frame. If you imagine the 4.5 million or so years of Earth's existence, starting at one fingertip and running all the way across to the other fingertip, life appeared on Earth really around the first elbow. Life was here very early, but it was just single cell. And then you go up over the shoulders and into the middle before there's even oxygen in the atmosphere, photosynthesis being invented. And then you go down the other arm and you're into the middle of the forearm before you have land animals. And then you go up into the hand before you start getting large animals. And, of course, civilization as we know it, if you had a nail file handy, you could remove civilization with just a few flicks of a nail file.
Yes.
That kind of puts us into perspective of all that life accomplished in 3 billion years, over 3 billion years of life was going on before we became aware of it, before we existed, and all the complexity. But then I end the story with, you know, that final hand. The future is what you reach out for.
Wow, that sounds amazing.
So you've created a deep ecology walk story, Fran, along your body.
Oh. Well, I've wondered whether I could print it on a long-sleeve T-shirt.
Excellent idea. That's brilliant. That's brilliant. And also, I love it that you physicalized it on your body. And then you could also have a deep ecology walk where people physically walk it afterwards, because that's, wow, I just love that. That's just so good. I had a 30-meter rope where we did it, starting with a bing bag in the middle, and it was really difficult to demarcate, you know, the things that we think of as you know, took so long, were so close to the end, you know. I couldn't mark the Industrial Revolution. I could only mark the humans, because on a 30-meter rope, that when you contract that down, it was just so, such a small amount of space at the end of the rope.
I want to just let people know it's 11 past 10 and 10 and I know we commit to going till 10, so if people need to get off, then they certainly go, and we probably should wrap it up. Do we, Papa Joe, anything else that you'd like to say first? Jenny?
No, I'm so sorry I was late, and I'm so grateful that you're all patient and you were still there when I got here, and I'm so grateful for all the beautiful impact, and I hope we could have more of a discussion on maybe on email afterwards, since we've run out of time. But yes, I'd love to hear from Papa Joe, and thank you, Fran, for coming, and I'm sorry we didn't have more time to hear from more people.
Well, thank you, Jenny. That was very rich. Okay, Papa Joe, are you still there?
Yes, I am. And I don't really need to say too much, but I really was glad to be here for this. And I would say that I really like to preach a lot about that fourth element in the artist story, which is exactly the place that we're talking about tonight. It's the storyteller, the listeners, the story, the place which it occurs. I think really summed that up wonderfully. Enjoyed the
call.
Oh.
Okay, is that it?
Thank you. Sorry, Papa Joe, you were breaking up a little bit, so I just partly caught that. But I think you were talking about the power of stories at place.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm going to start the and we hope to see you all back here on May 24th. All right.
May 21st.
Thanks, Lisa.
4th.
24th. Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Bye.
Happy
Thanks,
spring.
Everyone.
Thank you.
Bye, bye.
Happy autumn.
Nice.